the Greenian Report. The unusual, weird news, anomalies, exopolitics. It's Beyond the Fringe, where conspiracy theory can become conspiracy fact. This is the Greenian Report with your host, Mike Evans.
From hundreds of miles beneath terra firma and the depths of the hollow earth, live from the Greenian Bunker. Welcome again, I'm Micah Hanks. And you've locked in to the one and only Greenian Report. Glad to be here with you as always. Writer, world traveler, backseat philosopher. Oh, I forgot to add space-time traveler to that. But then again, anyone who moves around a good bit is a space-time traveler of sorts. Glad to be here in this space-time quadrant with you tonight as we begin our weekly foray into the unusual, the unexplained. Something is back in the news again. Well, it has been for a few days at least. But, I mean, this is one of these items that is ever-present. And so we'll be delving into Stephen Hawking's latest statements about alien life and the dangers that may await us. But you probably, like me, have noticed that, you know, week for week, month for month, the argument remains the same. The subject changes slightly. One week it's artificial intelligence, the next it's aliens. Is the subject warranted? Don't want to spend too much time talking about that, but since we bring it up, I might as well delve right in. I do want to mention, however, that in keeping with the Halloween season, we've got some special stuff in the coming days, and I want to kick things off this week as we're getting closer and closer to the end of October by revisiting a conversation, another ongoing conversation of sorts that we feature on this program. And that is one that we share with none other than Mr. Jim Harold of the Paranormal Podcast. He has his latest installment of reader-submitted, or I'm sorry, I guess listener-submitted, in his case, ghost stories. And he's going to be joining us in the second hour to share a few of those. That's always a fun time indeed. But getting back to this thing about Stephen Hawking, I think it actually first appeared last week. But Discovery News was reporting on the fact, yet again, that scientists aren't so sure that an actual intelligent alien, if it were to come to Earth and interact with us, would be so benign. Of course, they make the comparison to E.T., right? Now, in a recent interview with El País, the famed physicist Stephen Hawking posited that an alien visitation would put Earthlings in the same position as Native Americans when Columbus landed on their shores. And I'll tell you what this has to do with. I'm only catching this story now, but of course, last week in celebration of Columbus Day, they were regurgitating this same old argument. And that's not to diminish the ongoing debate about the legitimacy of Columbus Day and the controversy as it pertains to Native Americans and the treatment of the indigenous cultures that were here existent in North America when European settlers arrived. That's obviously a problem. On the heels of, or rather, I guess actually floating on the back of, that argument, we revisit Stephen Hawking's statements about alien visitation. And of course, it's well known what he'd said. Such advanced aliens would perhaps become nomads looking to conquer and colonize whatever planets they can reach. The likelihood that intelligent life is out there is up for debate. Less discussed are the conditions necessary to evolve a life form that's both smart and nice. But the lessons from Earth suggest that intelligence and aggression might evolve hand in hand. Now think about that for a moment. Intelligence and aggression might evolve hand in hand. I don't know that I agree, and I know that there are a lot of people out there who have warned me to be very careful about this discussion, but here's my take on this. When it comes to artificial intelligence, we could ask so perfect a question. AI, let's call it Bob. Bob Gunn. No, I'm kidding, actually, quoting Batman there, but no, Bob, would you help us end all suffering on Earth? And Bob comes through and says, affirmative. And then what happens is he, of course, ends all life on Earth. And by proxy, of course, all suffering is thus ended just as well. And we have a robo-apocalypse scenario. Some people have actually suggested this is a realistic concern and one that must be addressed as it relates to the discussion of whether or not alien life, or I'm sorry, artificial intelligence, if it were and eventually, I suppose it is an eventuality that it will come to pass that artificial intelligence will exist if we don't destroy ourselves first. In those circumstances, an intelligent computer may interpret human problems very differently, but if we're talking about biological extraterrestrials, leaving aside for the moment the notion that AI from outer space may be the alien life we first encounter, which again is, I guess, what would fall under the qualifications of being lifelike, something I've discussed a lot on the program in the past. Leaving AI out of the equation for a moment, if we encountered biological aliens that evolved, even under conditions different from us, I doubt that they're going to be operating with the mindset and under the conventions that people in the Middle Ages here on Earth operated under. And the reason I say that is because, again, if we look at the way that humans traveling into space would treat a planet today, let's look at ever since the 1960s with the Outer Space Treaty, what we clearly defined about what happens when we go to other planets. We do not allow ourselves, to, at least to the best of our ability, to cause any changes to the environment to which we travel. And this is the case with this Martian landing situation. Right now, the robots that we've sent up there, they're not really artificially intelligent, but they are remote-controlled robots. They are not allowed to go close to the water that we believe that we've discovered on Mars because of the concern over contamination. You know, this is how we are acting right now. There is a conscientious scientific effort not to invade or to infect even the environments which we are studying. If aliens travel out into space, I would probably say that they would, in likelihood, be scientists like Stephen Hawking, people with the very same sorts of concerns. Now, granted, we can't assume that intelligent alien life would think like we do. We can't anthropomorphize our expectations of alien life. But again, I would say that it's a 50-50 at very least. And that if they're anything like us, that by the time they actually get into space, maybe they are not going to act like Columbus and others did during the Middle Ages. And yes, we can look at the history of interactions on this planet, but sadly, through intelligence and through the proliferation of scientific advancement, we do learn, and we also reflect. The more we learn about ourselves, the more we get closer to trying to present, and this bringing artificial intelligence back into the equation here, but the closer we get to trying to replicate what we would call a perfect human intelligence, we're not going to try and create the perfect machine that's going to destroy us. Our aim, at least, is not to create Terminators, but to create a benign sort of intelligence that really exceeds the sorts of conditions that have led humanity to be very complicated. We look at a lot of evolutionary pressures, competition, and things like this, and the kinds of chemical drives that cause humans to act the way that we do. We have evolved to be this way because of the competition present on Earth has driven, well, of course, in part, evolution. I think that drives the adaptive component, but we also know that evolution is a result of the randomness of mutations that occur. But the point being is that, you know, environmental influences do affect and have shaped the path that we as a civilization have taken. And the more technologically proficient that we become, the more we become aware of those kind of things. The less dogmatic we become in our beliefs, the more aware we become of the necessities of maintaining cooperative and peaceful operations. Again, to assume that advanced extraterrestrials with all their knowledge and all of their technology available to them would behave like humans did in the Middle Ages, who were technologically superior, I mean, it's something that should be considered, but I don't know if it's the most likely situation. I'd like to hear your thoughts on that. If you'd like to chime in on that, info@graylianreport.com, that'll be our question of the week. And in the next segment, I do want to spend a little bit of time getting to some listener emails that I have neglected for weeks with a lot of travel and other things going on. So, but that said, I worry sometimes that the discussion about the eventuality of alien-human interactions, if it ever happens, I mean, for all you or I may know, life could be so rare in the universe, intelligent life and life capable of space travel, that would be conducive to a meeting between two extraterrestrial races. It may be rare enough that over the course of time, as it spans the universe, you know, billions and billions of years, it may be that a civilization may appear from time to time, but there are no two civilizations that are proficient enough technologically to be able to become space-faring civilizations at any one time. In other words, that there are no two whose civilizations and the span of their existence overlap for long enough for technological proficiency to occur. When we were still in the Stone Age, it very well may have been that the last remnants of a dying extraterrestrial race were consumed by a supernova. And that might have been the closest that we've come for all we know. And again, talking about the ancient alien idea, I think it is indeed possible, rather than ancient alien paleo contact here on Earth, that there had been advanced civilizations that maybe existed, but they could have existed well before our time here. We just don't know. There are a lot of components that really have to be thought about very carefully, very deeply. And I'm not trying to make an argument for benign space brothers here. I'm just saying that, you know, even in our attempts to try not to make assumptions about how alien life will be or what they will be or how they will interact with us, we can't escape the anthropomorphization of the argument. And I think that Stephen Hawking, in fairness, does that quite a bit too. Brilliant physicist though he is, I largely differ with him on his ideas about alien life, and especially, of course, his rather pointed argument against UFOs and philosophy. But I still admire the man. You'd have to admire anyone who, for the majority of his life, has suffered from motor neuron disease and yet has contributed probably more to the study of physics, and specifically the physics of black holes, than any other living human being. Interesting guy, indeed, and there's just no way to get around that. Looking at other things in the news and talking about this AI thing, another thing that I've neglected and I meant to talk about last week, and we'll get around to that right now, it's this Blue Brain project. And this is what's made headlines about this, the digital replication, at least in part, of a rat brain. That's right, this Blue Brain project has been working to digitally reconstruct a rat brain for about a decade now. And earlier this month, there was a paper that was published in Cell, the journal. And the group claims success of a sort of first draft of the project that has simulated 31,000 neurons out of approximately 21 million estimated to exist in the complete structure of a rat's brain. Those 31,000 virtual neurons include 207 different neuron subtypes with over 37 million connections between them. In other words, it's a very tiny chunk of a rat's brain, to be sure, but for some researchers, this level of digitization is incredibly exciting, and it goes without saying why. Of course, this is one step along the path toward the eventual digitization of a human brain, and thus, of course, we'll be nearing the sphere of artificial intelligence once again when that happens. But the Washington Post reported, unfortunately, this may not be the holy grail of neurological research that it seems to be, and this is the reason for the skepticism. Science Magazine apparently reported previously that the Blue Brain Project has attracted controversy for its high level of funding, and yet, in recent years, its lack of progress to match. And not everyone is thrilled with this much-hyped first draft. The Blue Brain Project has been hyped immensely. According to Moritz Helmestetter, he, of course, is the director of the Max Planck Institute for Brain Research, and he said, "What happened is exactly what we feared. There are no real findings. Putting together lots and lots of data, which is what he asserts that they have done, doesn't create new science." Now, other scientists have pointed out that this new model isn't capable of doing anything more impressive than existing models regarding the substructure of brains and their neural pathways. Models that, in fact, took much less work and funding than this one did. So the Blue Brain Project researchers say they'll continue to work toward a more thorough digital representation of the brain, but many people are looking at this and saying, you know, maybe this isn't the big story that it has been heralded as being. And many have. They've said, look, I mean, right here, we are now mapping the brain. Maybe we aren't really mapping the brain. But when it comes to discussion of the brain, this is something that's interesting to me. There have long been scientific studies that seek to understand what drives our actions. And I guess this comes back to the psychological debate over nature versus nurture. And I think, frankly, it's a bit of both. I know as a musician that obviously my father, being a very well-rounded musician, probably was conducive to certain traits being passed along to my brother Caleb and I, which have allowed us also to be good musicians. There are certain traits that obviously are carried over, but you can still be affected by things that you observe in your environment. This is the whole idea about adaptation, at least so far as how it relates to the things that we experience and how they shape the way that we act in life. Now, I'll note that Caleb and I are not twins, and I'd mentioned that twin studies have been interesting for a long time, but what's really fascinating about them is when you take a pair of twins and you see the course that their lives tend to take, from time to time, there are unique circumstances that appear that seem to suggest that there are motivating factors that push these twins in similar directions, even when, in those rare cases, they have been separated by birth. You'll hear the stories of the twins separated at birth, and that they both become firemen, and they both decide to wear their hair the same way. They'll adapt a similar style of dress. I mean, is there something that actually pushes twins to be similar even when they don't grow up around one another? Now, these two, like Caleb and I, were not twins, but this story about sisters that appeared in the Huffington Post recently, these girls began working together at the same hospital, but they've been separated for 40 years. And the story begins with a woman, Holly Hoyle O'Brien. Her birth name had been Park Nam-shin. She was born in South Korea. One night as a child, she woke up and she said to her father, she said, "My daddy died, I have a sister, and we need to find her." She and her half-sister, Yoon Suk, had spent their childhoods in separate orphanages in the country and were later adopted by different American families. The siblings didn't know where the other was for more than 40 years, and there was no record of O'Brien's sister in the orphanage where she had lived. But in my heart, she said, I knew she was out there somewhere. Well, she was right. But you won't believe this. Despite being adopted by different families and spending their childhoods apart and existing apart from each other for 40 years, there's been a strange twist of fate referred to by some as a miracle. The sisters were recently reunited after being hired by the same hospital and then being assigned to the same floor in Florida. According to O'Brien, the sisters' incredible story can be traced to one fateful night in the early 1970s, the last time that they would see each other for many decades. O'Brien had been just a child, but she remembered her stepmother gathering her sister in the middle of the night and fleeing the family home. They never returned. O'Brien was left in the care of her dad, who she describes as an alcoholic, and at the age of 5, she recalled being pulled out of school to identify her father's body after he wandered into the path of an oncoming train. Talk about a tough childhood. 4 years later, this would have been 1978, she was adopted from an orphanage by an American couple. They brought her to Virginia. What she didn't know was that her sister, Yoon Suk, had been adopted from another South Korean orphanage 2 years before, also by an American family. According to the Associated Press, Yoon Suk, now known as Megan Hughes, grew up in Kingston, New York, which was about 300 miles away from where her sister would be living. Now, what's interesting is that Hughes, who is 2 years younger than O'Brien, says she doesn't remember much about her childhood. But earlier this year in March, Hughes began working as a physical therapy assistant on the fourth floor of Doctors Hospital in Sarasota, Florida. Just 2 months earlier, her sister O'Brien had gotten a job at the same facility working as a nursing assistant. She was also assigned to the fourth floor. One of the patients told me there was another nurse named Megan who was from Korea, and she said, "You should talk to her. Maybe you're from the same town." Now, had they actually been twins, imagine how strange that would have been. Dr. O'Brien? No, I'm Dr. Hughes. But you look just like... Yeah. Who knows? Being siblings, they probably did look enough alike. In fact, looking at a picture of them here, they really do certainly appear similar. So the patients had said, you should talk to one another. The women began spending time together, and at first they didn't necessarily realize what was happening. They were stunned to find that there were a lot of similarities in their history. They began to think that they might be related, and finally they decided to take a DNA test, and it was found that indeed the tests were positive. These girls were sisters. They had been separated for 40 years, and after 4 decades apart, to the point that they aren't even able to recognize one another as sisters, working together on the same floor, in the same hospital, in the same state, in a country apart from where they both were born, they're reunited. I've said before in the past that improbable things happen all the time. It's not impossible. This is highly improbable, and I think that it certainly qualifies, like many are saying right now, as being damned close to being a miracle. And sometimes it really does bring to mind the old idea that there are no such things as coincidences that occur. You see the strange, improbable occurrences that reunite people from different lives, different parts of the world. Seems almost at times as though everything is meant to happen. So, something that's going to be meant to be in the next segment, I want to get to some email correspondence, which involves a lot of crypto news, as well as some debate over this program, Killing Bigfoot, in the next segment. We'll pick that up here on the Grayling Report when we return.
Hi, this is Jimmy Church of Faded Black. You're listening to Micah Hanks and the Grayling Report.
back. It is the Grayling Report. I'm Micah Hanks. More of the sounds of the John Stickley Trio. They've got a new album out called Lost at Last. Good friends of the program here. And very proud to feature their music. Being people who I actually get to perform with from time to time, we did a special show together on 4th of July weekend that featured John Stickley on guitar, Lindsey Pruitt of the band playing violin. Of course, Dakota Waddell, yours truly, and Charles Wood of Nitrograss playing together in Highlands, North Carolina. Talk about a sell-out show. I mean, it was incredible, and playing with some of the most incredible musicians I've ever known. But johnstickley.com is the website where you can learn more about them. If you're a musician or you are part of a group and you'd like to have your music featured on the program, from time to time we do that. We are music lovers here in the Grayling Bunker. You can email me about that, info@graylingreport.com. We're pretty selective. You know, I mean, there are certain styles and genres that just kind of, I think, complement the esoteric effluvium that we feature for you here on a weekly basis. Proud to put together a podcast that is quite unlike others in this genre. I always love it when people complain, you know, why don't you guys get this person or that person on, you know, do more interviews. Doesn't every podcast essentially just feature this? We're going to interview somebody on the show this week. We'll put half the interview up, but then we'll put the rest up for only subscribers. No, see, I'm not going to criticize anybody who does that, by the way. They're great shows. As a matter of fact, you know, my buddy's Ben and Aaron at Mysterious Universe feature a model very similar to that, but I'm doing no service to the community by just replicating what everybody else does. We bend to the will of no man here on the Grayling Report, do things very differently, and there's a good reason why, because we like variety. And so you're welcome to send along your contributions, whether they be news, stories, music, whatever else, info@graylingreport.com. And we'll be getting to some listener emails, another way that you can contribute to the program here in just a moment. But I wanted to bring up something that was funny and I just loved. This is, of course, a reference to what appeared on an episode recently of Doctor Who, which is interesting for two reasons. One has to do a bit with fate, and actually they both have to do with fate and destiny, but another has to do with a time travel paradox that I have discussed before. In fact, when I did a online lecture for Jim Harold's Plus Club on time travel, one of the points I brought up was the following paradox, which is that a professor travels forward in time and he reads a mathematical equation from a textbook that appears in the future. He returns to the past and discusses this with a student who polishes the idea and produces the concept, which upon being later published becomes the very same book that the professor read where he learned of the idea. Now here's the catch. The idea didn't come from the professor. It also didn't come from the student. Each learned about it secondhand, so to speak, and yet it comes to exist nonetheless. This thought experiment seems to suggest the idea that information can enter the universe from nowhere, which is indeed pretty disturbing because, of course, it contradicts the orderly nature of things expressed within general views toward thermodynamics. And as a matter of fact, I think from a physicist's perspective, there's a close relationship between entropy and information, and so the idea of information entering the universe from nowhere like this is akin to breaking thermodynamic laws. In other words, it presents us with some real problems, or we might even argue it could disprove the notion of time travel being viable at all. This information paradox is very similarly outlined in the episode in question of Doctor Who that I had mentioned, and this episode in question is titled Before the Flood, one of a two-part series, which begins with Peter Capaldi storming about the TARDIS, and the Doctor is telling us about the bootstrap hypothesis. Google it, he tells you. And he discusses a very similar circumstance, except it's like this. He discusses going back in time to meet Ludwig von Beethoven. You go back to find him, and he's not there. But what you do is, being a fan, of course, of Beethoven's works, you copy the music, you present the music, and you create, therefore, Beethoven's symphonies. Presumably you yourself are actually remembered as Ludwig von Beethoven, but what happens is that you did this in order to counteract traveling back in time and finding that no such man had existed, and thus you create his music and it comes to pass that you discover it in the future. But the question is, where do the symphonies come from? Who created the music? It was pretty brilliantly put together in this episode of Doctor Who, and I love that because what they do is they're actually presenting real philosophical paradoxes and the discussion of them and working this into the writing of the show and not just playing with the idea of time travel itself, because this is a very real hypothesis that has been dealt with. The information paradox, as it might be called, would entail that there is a modality, if time travel is existent or is ever to be achieved, there is a way that information could seemingly come to exist in our universe from nowhere, which does seem to defy the laws of thermodynamics. How do we get around that? Pretty interesting stuff. The episode in question deals a good bit with the Doctor attempting to save not only the life of his companion Clara, but also dealing with the fact that apparently his ghost appears in the future, which seems to suggest that he dies. And what is interesting is, of course, he is able to prevent all of this from happening by playing off of the cues of the apparent future events, which thus affect the past. The question is, where did the future events, which don't come into play, where did they come from? What eventuality led to that, which was, in fact, no eventuality at all? It's a bit of a mind-bender, and it's a good one, and it's very similar to my thought processes in employing philosophical logic to the idea of thermodynamics and time travel under the constraints of general relativity. It's believed that it could, in theory, happen, but there are some real questions that emerge if we are to assume that time travel could happen. And we take into consideration things like fate and destiny. Is time something that exists indefinitely? And when we talk about the infinite potentials of time, if past, present, and future all exist, what does that have to say about predestination? You know, especially within the idea of a block universe. Now, what's funny is, I had captured a snippet of audio some time ago where Peter Capaldi, the actor who plays the Doctor, is on Larry King's new program. It's carried by Hulu and other mediums. And Larry King, of course, a guy who has catered very much to the discussion of UFOs and similar things over the years, he's asking Peter Capaldi, who now plays the Doctor, if he feels like he was destined to play that role.
Why did you take this role?
You know, it's apart from the fact that it's in the UK, an iconic and famous role. When I was a little kid, my favorite show was Doctor Who. And I used to write to the actor who played Doctor Who. And he changed a few times when I was young, but they would send me back autographed pictures. And I thought the show was the most amazing thing. And one day I got a package through the mail, and it was a script. Can you imagine anyone doing this? No, this would never happen. A producer of Doctor Who sent me a script for a forthcoming episode, and I had never seen a script. I didn't know there was such a thing as a script, that a TV show was generated from this material. And for me, it became one of the things that made me want to become an actor and become part of this world, because suddenly someone was showing me how it was made. So for me to find myself being offered this role that was key in bringing me into the business in the first place was just a remarkable situation. It was like serendipity. It was like fate, you know? So I had to do it.
So perhaps not paradoxical, but nonetheless serendipitous, to borrow Capaldi's own words. It is interesting, no matter how you choose to look at it, the way that events tend to play out. And indeed, you'll find those little serendipitous circumstances that emerge from time to time. Moving on to listener emails, Leon writes, Micah, I'd never heard of this phenomenon known as skyquakes until I began researching it for myself. Now, at 6:40 a.m. on September 22nd, my wife, my best friend, and I all heard these sonic booms. At first, I thought we had heard an earthquake, or maybe that someone had run into our building with a giant truck. I live in Oglala, South Dakota, and run a recreation center and a church. We have two 30-foot-tall buildings large enough for a full-court middle school basketball court to fit inside each building, and both buildings shook when the booms came. I've experienced earthquake tremors, and they were very different. I also grew up in Central Florida, where my mother was an employee of the Kennedy Space Center. And during the summers, we ran around there, and I know what a sonic boom sounds and feels like. I also would mention that since the booms, we've had no cell phone coverage in our town. Maybe it's a coincidence, maybe not, but our tower since then has been completely useless. Now that is odd. Anyway, he said, that is what happened, and I wanted to report it because it seems like every report happens around a coast or a large body of water, but if you check us on a map, that's not the case here. Oglala is found on the Pine Ridge Indian Reservation in the southwest corner of South Dakota. Thanks, Leon. And he's absolutely right, and thank you for pointing that out, by the way, Leon, because indeed, I've noticed that a lot of the boom reports do occur near bodies of water. We've talked about that before on the program, which does point to some sort of a geophysical component, but yet again, that doesn't necessarily always have to be the case for these kind of things that happen. Stephen writes, Mike, I heard this gentleman on the new Art Bell radio program. It's very interesting stuff. I think he would make a great guest. And the guest in question here is none other than Ron Moorhead, who is one of the men who was attributed to having captured what are known as the Sierra sounds, purported Sasquatch language. And at his website, Ron Moorhead, you actually can hear the recordings of these. Now, many have dismissed them as hoaxes. There have been certain linguists who have listened to them and said without question that these things are actually the voices of Sasquatches talking. Sasquatch seems to be a recurring theme in listener emails this week, as well as cryptozoology in general. Justin writes, Mike, I'm writing to see if you've ever gained any knowledge about this thing that I saw one night. I've been searching for clues as to what this could have been ever since. First, I must say I have always been grounded in science from an early age. I try to rationalize everything I hear or say before drawing conclusions. I've been somewhat of a closet physics and astronomy geek since as far back as I can remember. Hey, Justin, you and I both. By day, I'm a filmmaker, but by night, I study quantum physics for fun, if that tells you anything. I can relate. He says, I'd never really thought to question reality as we know it from the experts until certain things I have seen have forever altered my way of thinking on how the universe actually works. This is one of the couple of things that assures me we know way less than a lot of the scientific community may think. So this particular instance happened one summer night in Loudoun, Tennessee, while I was driving from a girlfriend's house back in 1993. I remember it being almost midnight, and I was eager to get to bed. I remember it being a dark and cloudy night, but no rain. I was driving down a back road that I'd always traveled on, and I came upon a curve that had a bank on the left side of the road. On the right side of the road is a field about 100 yards wide with a tree line surrounding it. I was going about 30 miles per hour when I saw some black figure coming down the bank on the left, and then it started running onto the road. Now, thinking it was a dog, I slammed on my brakes and skidded to a halt. This thing had moved slightly past the double yellow line in the road by that time and suddenly stopped as I came to a stop in front of it. I probably stopped 6 feet away from this thing with my passenger headlight pointing directly at it. It suddenly turned as if to look at me, and that's when I thought this is some little person. It walked upright on two legs and had two arms, but I knew right away this was no person because, first of all, it was only maybe 2.5 to 3 feet tall. I don't see how a child would be out in the middle of nowhere. It's just before midnight on a school night. But the biggest reason I knew that this was something very out of the ordinary is the fact that my headlights were pointing right at it only 6 feet away, and yet there was no light reflecting off the thing. It was pitch black. Not like a black object where you can still see light reflecting off of it. No, there was no light reflecting off this thing, like it was a void. But what I could easily see was the outline of this thing from my headlights on the road behind it, and that's where it gets even weirder. When it stopped and turned, I could see the outline of it turning to look at me with its shoulders turning toward me and its arms slightly out as if being startled. It was in mid-stride. I could see a knee bent and a pointy foot, what looked like maybe its left foot, the right foot and leg obscured by what I can only describe as a long coat. The coat collar was flipped up and the collar was pointy and sticking out from its shoulders and looked like some sort of a trench coat. Its neck was obscured because of the collar, and it also had a tall, pointy hat with wide brims that stood out almost past its shoulders. The hat and what I could only describe as a trench coat were rigid in appearance, not floppy like I would imagine being as long as it was. The top of its pointy hat probably came up to the hood of my car. The car was a 1991 Ford Escort, not exactly a big car. This thing, from my best guess, had to be about 2.5 feet tall, and its hat made it close to 3 feet tall. It stood there for several seconds, enough time for me to say, "What in the hell?" And I reached for my headlights to click them on brighter. At the same time, I wasn't sure if my high beams were on it because I couldn't see any light reflecting off the thing. When I clicked the beams, they went to low, so realizing that I quickly set them to high again, as soon as I did that, it turned and faced the field. I couldn't make out any face because it looked like the collar was covering it up. It then ran across the road into the field very quickly and vanished into the trees, staying real close to the ground. The light reflecting off the road and surrounding area was enough for me to see it run through the field and into the tree line. My first reaction was to grab the door and get out to try and have a better look of it running through the field, but then I thought, what if there are more? So instead I pushed the gas and I got out of there quickly. I didn't sleep much that night, and I went on and on about it to my mom and my brother when I got out or rather when I got home, but being so late as this was, they weren't enthusiastic as I was about this. So the next morning, I went back down that road, and I noticed something that I hadn't seen the night before. I turned around and stopped right where I had stopped, even noticing my skid marks from the night before, and on the right side of the road was a barbed wire fence. It was a fence in use because in the field was a cow pasture, and I could now see it. There was hardly any room for a creature that size to get through without a struggle. However, when this thing ran, it didn't jump or struggle at all. It stayed close to the ground and moved faster than I could ever run. So I don't know how, but it seemed to have gone through that fence. I would have noticed it jumping over the fence or even slowing down at the fence, and yet it never seemed to slow down when it ran. To this day, it has baffled me and, frankly, at times creeped me out. I've searched for a long time to see if there's anything reported like this, and I haven't found anything quite like it. The closest I've come to finding is what's called the Hat Man. Reports, but all of those speak of a tall shadow figure wearing a hat, and this was not tall. I've also looked into the black dog phenomenon, but I can assure you that this didn't resemble a dog unless it was Scruff McGruff. Come to think of it, he wore a trench coat as well, but hardly the same thing. If you know anything like this, please share so I can find more clues, and thanks for your efforts in explaining the universe, and keep up the great work. Justin. Well, in this case, I certainly can't explain that easily. I mean, we hear reports from time to time of things like this, and throughout the decades, UFO reports especially have been rife with alleged stories about diminutive humanoids. If you read in some of Jerry Clark's writing on Fortiana, he talks a lot about diminutive humanoids, little green men, in fact, and often small individuals are described in conjunction with UFO landings, particularly the ones that occurred throughout the late 1950s and the duration of the 1960s, on up into the 1970s just as well. But I want to point out that descriptions of diminutive beings like this are not necessarily whatever their source may be. They're not mutually exclusive to the presence of UFOs in the area. When you're describing a darkened figure like that in a part of rural Tennessee, the first thing that came to mind for me were similar reports that have been told to me over the years by hunters, but they describe very clearly an ape-like creature, something akin to a Bigfoot. And on that note, I got an email, interesting one, from Bob. He said, regarding the Bigfoot legend, I have had personal experience with what seemed to be a Bigfoot. While I was stationed in the U.S. Army at Fort Polk, Louisiana, my encounter took place, and this is what happened. I was on a night compass course with three of my fellow soldiers. We became disoriented. He says one is never lost in the U.S. Army. And eventually, we left the confines of the post, and while trying to reorient ourselves, we became aware of a pair of red eyes glowing in the glare of our flashlights. Now, there was also a very foul odor in the air. We continued searching for our way back to camp, and the creature followed us as we walked. Eventually, we reached a hard ball road. This is an Army term for a paved road. We started walking down it toward an entrance gate to the fort. While walking along, we spotted a car, and a gentleman stopped to give us a ride, and upon entering the car, and before any of us said a word, the car's driver asked us the following: were you guys being followed by something? He said about 50 yards behind you, there was a tall, shaggy animal walking on two legs. When I got closer to it, the thing seemed to go to four legs, and then ran into the woods. That's what the driver had said. Now, after relating our story to our fellow soldiers, we found that we were not the only ones with a tale to tell. There apparently had been many tales of this strange kind of a being told in the area of Louisiana. The creature even had a name. Locals called it Zeke the Swamp Monster. The story I have told even made the local paper. I, for one, believe in the existence of Bigfoot, despite the lack of evidence so far. This creature was not in my imagination because it was with three other people that this occurred. If this were a phantom beast, then it fooled about five people. We must all have been experiencing the same dream at that same time. Sincerely, Robert Jones, U.S. Army retired. What a story. And the point about the thing taking off on all fours is similar to the stories I've been told about the creatures seen in Tennessee. There were a couple of hunters who, years ago, I was investigating a report around the Jacksboro area in eastern Tennessee. And I remember my associate Brian Ledford and I had driven over there and spoken to the locals and interviewed a number of people. And Lauren Coleman at the time and I were in close contact, and he had asked for any information I was able to uncover about this. And at one point, we were actually chased, Brian and I, in his pickup truck, by a Park Service vehicle that followed us, tailing us down this park road. And we were at one point getting a bit concerned, and so we pulled over, and this car went all the way down to this cul-de-sac, turned around and sat there and waited as though expecting us to head down that way. But at that point, we turned around and we left. So it seemed that the Park Service in that area didn't really necessarily like people snooping around at that time, which was a little interesting. That was the only thing that was out of the ordinary that we noticed. But WATE out of Knoxville had a thread on their website. They had a forum, and they had a thread about this Campbell creature, as they called it, because it was Campbell County, I believe. And the Campbell Critter thread featured a lot of different stories that people were telling, but I posted on there and said, I'm an independent investigator, and I'm just interested if people, you know, say that they've seen any animals in that area. And there was a hunter who contacted me, and he said, you know, my brother-in-law and I, we were on a hunting trip years ago, and we saw something. We had split up, and we took off in different directions, and as we were coming around on either side of this valley, we saw, I didn't know that my brother-in-law had seen it at the time, but he later told me that he had, but I know that I observed this dark, what looked like a figure of a man, but very tall with longish arms. And he said that at one point, the thing became aware of my presence, and it took off running, but when it ran, he said it went into a strange loping run where it ran on all fours. He said it was very similar to what you would expect of a chimpanzee. When a chimpanzee is seen running, they can walk on their hind legs, but they would move on all fours, knuckle walking, so to speak. It's interesting that these descriptions of these, especially in the South, these creatures seem to involve this locomotion that when they're trying to move quickly, they take to all fours. Pretty strange stuff. Those are the emails that we get from the listeners for this week at very least. And if you've got a similar story you'd like to send along, info@graylianreport.com is the way to reach me. You can also reach me, info@micahhanks.com. I noticed that more people who are trying to reach me use that address. They both come to the same place. Yours truly. Love to hear from you. When we have time, we'll try and get to a few of those. When we come back here on the program, we'll pick up where we've left off, rounding out this hour here on the Graylian Report. Stay with us. Mountains of Appalachia. I'm Micah Hanks. This is the Graylian Report. So on the heels of Bob's story from the last segment, in fact, the numerous stories that allude to a cryptozoological sort of a component on the peripheries of existence, I want to spend a little bit of time here discussing, first of all, some controversy that erupted a few weeks ago at an event, as well as something that a leading expert said that really mirrors some sentiments I've expressed on this program about that famous Patterson-Gimlin film in weeks past. And first and foremost, what we're discussing here, of course, is Bigfoot. The Patterson-Gimlin film being that which, of course, is the film made in 1967, Bluff Creek, California. Roger Patterson, Bob Gimlin purportedly find a female Sasquatch and film it. And it's remained an item of controversy. And John Bendernagel, being a scientist who has taken seriously the discussion of Bigfoot, there's a Netflix documentary that you can find. Actually, I think it was produced by Gaia MTV, but it's been made available on Netflix. It's called Bigfoot's Reflection, in which a number of scientists are discussing how to bring humanity and scientific method to the pursuit of Bigfoot. But Bendernagel appears in this documentary on Netflix, Bigfoot's Reflection, and he made some interesting statements during the portion where they spend time discussing the Patterson-Gimlin film. Here's what he had to say.
People say, that's proven to be a hoax, right? Well, no, it hasn't been proven, but that's the perception out there. So I don't raise that film anymore, and it's very sad, But raising it as evidence just gets you into a discussion about he says, she says, and claims and counterclaims. I think we should just put that film aside for now, get on with the really hard evidence, especially the tracks, and then one day that we can bring that film back and say, well, what we now know about the Sasquatch is there in that film.
It's a very interesting statement that he made, especially given the circumstances that I presented about the film. Again, not to try and make an argument for or against it, but the fact that it has not been successful in convincing the scientific community anything more than what many are predisposed toward belief in, which is either a Bigfoot that already exists, or, as the scientific community generally accepts, a man in an ape suit being the likely character in the film. That has not proven anything, sadly. Good though the film appears to be, and as compelling as it may be, if indeed, at some point, better evidence that suggests the existence of a creature like Bigfoot is forthcoming, and hence we may have to revisit the film and say, okay, rather than what Bendernagel said in that segment, that, oh, well, here we have what the evidence seems to show, I think the question would be, now, with the evidence before us, is it consistent with what we saw in the film, or is the film and its subject consistent with the new evidence that is a better case, or that presents a better case for the physical existence of a creature like Bigfoot? And many would argue that without a body, we will never have what one would call hard evidence, that a body has to exist, or at very least a physical specimen. Some would argue you don't need a full body, but you know, if you find a Bigfoot, you know, cut off the hand, cut off a fingertip, you know, do something. But we need proof. We need something that we can use to extract physical evidence and thus prove that there is some variety of hominid out there existent, some species that is unrecognized by science. And my buddy Jeff Adamson and I, when we catch up and hang out from time to time, this often comes up in relation to that discussion. You know, we need a body. And as grisly as it sounds, to quote the late Grover Krantz, that body is what's going to be required before we can actually prove the existence of Bigfoot. A film alone, as we have seen, would not be enough to prove Bigfoot's existence. And so there's this television program that I know about. I have not watched, obviously, since I don't own a television. Killing Bigfoot is what this program is called. And at a recent festival, there were three cast members of this program, Killing Bigfoot, that were involved in what was described as a lively argument. But there was actually quite a lot of, despite some support for the idea, a lot of open hostility that was presented toward them at the Hunobia Bigfoot Festival and Conference in Hunobia, Oklahoma. Some were shouted at by audience members, called liars, and asked to take a polygraph test. And, of course, pro-life Bigfoot attendees spoke up for not killing the creature. There was an article that was featured in the Effingham Daily News that read as follows. I know a lot of people here killing Bigfoot. It's bad and everybody hates us and we get a lot of hate mail, according to Barry Schockemole, Killing Bigfoot cast member from Oswego, Oklahoma. He told the conference that they are researchers who do not go out with a gun every time. The festival, which ended Sunday, raised money for scholarships for graduating high school seniors in some of the poorest parts of Oklahoma. This according to Tom Hefner, head of the Bigfoot Scholarship Fund. I believe that Dakota and I may have touched on the story of the Bigfoot conference used for purposes of raising money for college scholarships on the Crypto X podcast, but again, it's interesting that so much controversy erupted there. Jim Lancaster, a Killing Bigfoot cast member from Louisiana, said a voucher specimen, i.e. a dead Bigfoot, is needed to prove that the creature exists. Lancaster's been hunting Bigfoot now for 25 years. He says, we go to areas that people have had problems with these Bigfoot creatures coming around their homes. According to the BFRO, the Bigfoot Field Research Organization, there have been 90 instances of Bigfoot sightings that have occurred in Oklahoma over the years, and of those, 23 are said to have come in LaFleur County, where Hunobia sits. So a lot of people are really concerned about this discussion of killing Bigfoot. Michael Humphreys was another member of the cast of the program Killing Bigfoot, a name, by the way, which to me seems to be more aimed at attempting to sensationalize the search for Bigfoot rather than advocating killing one. But let's face it, if you want to get people's attention, you call your show Killing Bigfoot. That's one way to do it. Anyway, Michael Humphreys had said, quote, these things can get extremely aggressive. I don't like them scaring the kids. He said his daughter, his niece, and his nephews had been terrorized by one. Now, some audience members agreed Lancaster could defend against an aggressive Bigfoot. Others peppered him with questions about why killing is necessary with a rare, elusive species, and why they hunt with bullets instead of cameras or tranquilizer darts. Some asked questions about illegal animal abuse and killing what may be a part human. "Who made you God to kill an animal like that?" shouted one man in the audience. "You're not God." When asked how close he'd come to killing a Bigfoot, Lancaster replied, "Close." "Just fear based on nothing is not a reason to kill," one audience member said. You have to have a basis. Now, Lancaster dismissed efforts by other conference researchers to prove Bigfoot's existence with sightings, photos, and language analysis or DNA. Lancaster and Dr. Samuel Webb Sintel, a conference speaker, got into a heated exchange over whether Lancaster hunted and shot a Bigfoot who escaped. Both accused the other of lying and making up stories. Harvey Pratt, a sketch artist for the Oklahoma State Bureau of Investigators, told the conference of his interviews with Bigfoot witnesses and said, "There is definitely one. There's a species. I don't know why we don't know more, why we can't prove more. There's a lot of history, a lot of sightings. It's all over the world, in fact." Well, I'll tell you this, when it comes to the discussion of whether or not there's enough evidence to support the existence of creatures and why science doesn't seem to be moving forward. Another thing that Bendernagel said in the Bigfoot's Reflection documentary is, you know, if my friends in the biological community were to assist in the study of Bigfoot, he feels that we would be making strides in leaps and bounds toward unraveling the truth behind the Bigfoot mystery. He, in fact, says that although their actions are admirable, in large part, the efforts of the amateurs, because of the void left where science won't get involved in the search for Bigfoot, and of course the fear of loss of credibility for those who do so, it does present this void in which the amateur enthusiasts kind of enter the picture, but they often don't have the funding. A lot of them don't have the discipline and the training scientifically to be able to make good determinations about the proper methodology applied to the study of a creature, especially one as controversial as Bigfoot, something large, something intelligent, something very manlike, and yet something that is largely ruled impossible. Pratt apparently had been interviewed or had interviewed people in California, Oregon, Washington, Oklahoma, Arkansas, Utah, Minnesota, and Texas. And again, he produces drawings of Bigfoot based on these interviews. He also showed a rock art painting of Bigfoot, which was several hundred years old, and he told of tribes who called Bigfoot the hairy man, the boss of the woods, the medicine man, and claimed in these legends that these creatures showed herbs which were medicinal. You know, the state of Bigfoot research has largely remained unchanged, I would say, for decades. Unlike UFO phenomena, I'll say this, I think that Bigfoot research has always been considered, relegated to the lunatic fringe. I can't think of any time where the academic community has really been on board with the serious study of Bigfoot. And if there have been government studies into whether or not Bigfoot exists, I can tell you with certainty that those have not been widely publicized. With UFOs, at very least, we see that with Project Blue Book and other different organizations and operations carried out over the years, There have been official methods of inquiry that have been applied more seriously to the UFO problem. And I guess that this, or and I say problem again because at the time of Project Blue Book, the UFO community didn't exist. What this was an apparent phenomenon that had national security implications. And with those national security implications, of course, came the potential threat of danger. We didn't know if these were enemy technology. We didn't know if this was, again, alien visitation. Who knows? And so it's understandable due to the national security component why UFOs would at one time be taken seriously. Not so much today, but Bigfoot's never seemed to have been afforded that assurance of, hey, at least this is something that is seriously enough a concern that we will look into it and then later dismiss it. There's never, to my knowledge, really been a well-rounded, multi-leveled participation by the scientific community to study Bigfoot. Maybe it's getting close to time. We'll pick things up on the other side of the break here on the Grayling Report.
You're listening to the KGRA Digital Broadcasting Station, Van Buren, Arkansas, Sarasota, Florida.
You know, it is that time of the year. So many of us who listen to this program, it's our very favorite time of the year. I know it's mine. And with all the traveling I've been doing and all the busyness that just tends to descend upon us right here around in Asheville, what we call the leaf season, it's nice to be able to kick back by the campfire, listen to the night sounds, and just enjoy the ambiance that this season provides. And here on this podcast, we like to do that from time to time. We like to feature stories. You don't have to always be probing or analyzing meticulously the science behind everything seemingly anomalous in the world, because myth and folklore, this is an important part of what we do. And from time to time, a good story is important just as well. It's a uniting experience for all of us. I know it's been the case for me that a certain unity has come out of my relationships with people in this field and sharing knowledge and sharing stories. And so at least once a year, especially around the time of Halloween, I love to get this gentleman on this program to share some stories. He's got a brand new book out. He happens to be a dear friend and a fellow podcaster, and certainly no stranger to any Grailian Report listeners. Mr. Jim Harrell, the one and only, joins us tonight. Sir, how are you, Jim?
I'm doing well. Thank you so much for allowing me to come into the bunker here and spend some time around the electronic campfire, share some stories. So it's always great to do the Paranormal Report with you, but it is a special time when we get to be a part of the Grailian Report. So thank you for allowing me to spend some time with you and with your audience.
And keep in mind, folks, I didn't even make him wear the blindfold when he came down the elevator shaft.
That's true.
This time.
That's true.
Yes,
this
now,
time.
Yeah. But now you know it's like knowing the way to the Batcave. He knows how to get here. But that's okay, Jim. The door's always open for you here in the Grailian Bunker. So you've got another installment of your very popular book series that deal with true ghost stories. What number are we on right now?
Number four, believe it or not, True Ghost Stories, Jim Harrell's Campfire 4. Now, I do want to be clear. Now, we do call it True Ghost Stories, but it's not just ghost stories. There's a couple of UFO stories in there. There's just some plain weird ones that are in there. We're going to share maybe one of those tonight. But the lion's share are ghost stories, and it seems to strike a chord with people, because I think we all have inherently our own experiences. Almost everybody, either directly or a friend or family member, has experienced something strange. And these stories just resonate, whether you're talking about my program, you talk about something ghost to ghost, or you talk about something as far back as early settlers gathering around their own campfires and telling their stories. I know my family was from Appalachia, and some of the best times I remember growing up as a kid was sitting around and listening to the grown-ups tell stories. And there'd be a lot of fish stories, or this happened to me that time, but there would be a time that when the stories would turn to the supernatural. And that was my favorite time. And hopefully some of that's recreated through the Campfire series. Each book has about 70 stories in it, culled from my podcast of the same name. And it's just a lot of fun, and I look forward to this time every year just as you do.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. I'm just like you, by the way. I mean, we literally, when I was a child, sat around the campfire, and my mom would tell stories. And it was funny how it comes back around. You and I both growing up interested in this. Here we are, grown men. Well, at least, you know, in our outward appearance. Some would say we're very young at heart, but then again, you're only as old as you feel, which is why say that I'm a time lord. I feel like an old man. But sitting in Eureka Springs, Arkansas, having lunch with Travis Walton, and he had asked me, what got you into all this? And I actually said to him, I said, you know, Travis, it was my mother telling me your story by a campfire one night. And there's just an incredible magic that occurs in that setting, which is one reason I enjoy the way that you present your stories so much. So without further ado, let's get into this. I know that there are a whole batch of brand new stories in this new volume. Why don't we kick off with, I know that there's one story, and there are a few favorites of mine. One of these has to do with a woman who was pursued by something malevolent.
Yeah, and that's, you know, a lot of times ghost stories can be kind of innocuous or friendly, but this particular story, not a ghost story, but certainly something that dealt with an entity, was quite frightening. This goes back to 2008, and this is Emily from Oklahoma. She was a caller to our program, and she said she went to the local big box store to pick some things up, but this was about 1 or 2 o'clock in the morning, and she wasn't able to find what she wanted. So she walked back out of the store into her car, and she was kind of fiddling with her iPod, looking for something to listen to, maybe one of our programs, perhaps. And she looked up and she got this feeling that she was being stared at, with apologies to Rupert Sheldrake. And she raised her head, she turned around, and she sees this guy two or three spaces away in this older green sedan. And there's this guy in the driver's seat with shaggy black hair staring daggers through her. Now, that's kind of scary, you know, a young woman in a parking lot and kind of this creepy guy looking at her.
Oh, yeah.
But it got creepier when she looked at him and realized that his eyes were abnormal. They weren't completely black, but the iris was much larger than it should have been. And they were mostly black, pure black. And he was still as a statue, not blinking, but just staring at her intently. Now, she says later in the story, she grew up goth, so she's used to being stared at. But this was something different, almost like he was staring down into her soul. And she thought, okay, here's what I'm going to do. I'm going to pull out. Hopefully he won't follow me. And if he follows me, I'll call 911. Very level-headed. She proceeds to pull out of the parking lot, and he follows her. So she said, I'll call 911.
Huh.
Her phone falls on the floor, Murphy's Law. So she says, you know what I'm going to do? I'm going to drive to, like a bat out of you-know-where, to the police station. So basically, she's in this residential slash commercial area, probably 35 miles per hour, 25 miles per hour. She's going 45 miles per hour, literally hoping she'll get pulled over. This guy is tailing her, but not just a little bit. He's right on her bumper. He's honking at her, turns around, pulls to the side of her and starts staring at him, not looking at the road. And she's freaked out. She's like, this is horrible. All the time he has this weird look about him, this otherworldly look. She gets to the police station. He pulls back behind the police station and seemingly disappears. And she thinks, well, that was weird. But she says, okay, he's not there. Everything's fine. And at that point, she says, well, I'm not going to go in with the police or anything like that. He's gone. I'm going to drive over to my boyfriend's house. So she drives over to her boyfriend's house. They've been together a month or two. She was in tears. She told him what happened. And her boyfriend got this look on his face like he knew what happened. And she said, all right, dude, what's up? What do you know that you're not telling me? And the man asked her, her boyfriend asked her, did he look kind of Hispanic with shaggy black hair? And Emily said, yeah, how did you know that? Because she hadn't described the man to her at all. And he said, yeah, that was Azrael. That's the demon I used to work with back when I was a Satanist. Since you're connected to me now, he's probably just checking you out, but it's probably a good thing that you came here. Uh-huh. And Emily says, well, first of all, I never knew you were a Satanist. And secondly, what other demon friends that you have that I should know about?
Goodness.
Now, a couple things came out of this. Their relationship didn't last much longer. Emily said, well, you know, I'm not particularly religious, but I think there's some things that you should fool with and maybe other things you should leave alone. And this is one of them. Secondly, she said, she vets her boyfriends much more carefully these days. And finally, when she's at that big box store at 1 or 2 o'clock in the morning, she always looks around to see if Azrael is there. Hasn't seen him yet, but it's always in the back of her mind. And that's Emily's story. Emily from Oklahoma.
Yeah, let's hope she never sees him again. You know, that almost reminded me a little of the story of Richard Ramirez.
Oh, yeah.
You know,
scary.
Yeah, and so, you know, a word of caution to our ladies out there, but really to anybody, always be aware of your surroundings. You know, a story like that, to me, again, read into it what you will, but it doesn't take a demon pursuing you for that to have been an obvious potential danger. You know?
Absolutely.
Gosh, I tell you. Oh, nothing. I tell you, and I'll say this, too, before we move on to the next story, Jim, that for me, ghosts and demons and things like that, you know, all those spectral creatures, you know, that come from the land of myth and fear. Yeah, those are scary, but there's nothing scarier as far as monsters go to me than the kind that walks on two legs, if you know what I mean.
Yeah, absolutely right. No question about that.
So, boy, that's a way to kick things off. We've got a couple more stories here. You know, there was one, and this is a story talking about things that are unsettling. I know that late night talk host George Norrie really has a thing about Ouija boards, not in a good way either. He's not comfortable with Ouija boards. Now, I've only ever employed a Ouija board one time, Jim, and that was at a seance, which was almost more of a mock seance. And what I mean by that is it was a psychological experiment that we did years ago at an antebellum mansion that I have associations with here in Asheville, North Carolina, called the Reynolds Mansion. And it's little known, but I actually wrote a book about Reynolds Mansion a few years ago, and we outline the proceedings of that that spirit session, if you want to call it that, in the last chapter of that book that describes our very own Matthew Oakley and I working with a Ouija board. But apart from that, and I maintain that that was a different set of circumstances where we did a number of different experiments that included psychometry, you know, some electrical experimentation, all kinds of things. I generally am not very comfortable with Ouija boards either. I'm not really superstitious, but I remember that the esotericist Manly P. Hall said, whether it's psychological or something indeed spiritual, the after effects that occur with those who experiment with Ouija boards generally, you know, 9 times out of 10 are not favorable. They are not good. They don't bear well for those who have been participants. Now, I believe we've got a Ouija board story from you in this new volume just as well, correct?
Well, there are Ouija board stories. I know the one that we were going to cover is the Karen Carpenter story, which didn't specifically involve a Ouija board, but it's much the same principle, if that's okay, if we can talk about that one. But still, the idea of a Ouija board, right, is calling up spirits. Mm-hmm. And, you know, the thing that I always wonder about when you call up a spirit, particularly with a Ouija board or even without, if you're trying to call up Aunt Millie and supposedly Aunt Millie shows up, might it be an imposter spirit or something more sinister? So I think that this story does fit with that comparison, because while it doesn't specifically involve a Ouija board, it was a seance. And these young people were trying to call up somebody very specific, and that is Karen Carpenter. Now, let me say a word about Karen Carpenter. First of all, a tremendous talent, in my view, who was stilled far too soon. What a great, great voice. And you remember it every Christmas when you hear that great Christmas tune, Merry Christmas, Darling. You hear it back on the air. A real shame what happened to her. And, you know, in no way is this meant as a disrespect to her. And I want to make that very clear. I even say something like this in the book, a great respecter of her work. And some people consider the Carpenters kind of tacky or whatever. I always thought they were great.
No, they were
personally
great.
And what a fantastic voice to despite the instrumentation, that voice is timeless. But nevertheless, this young lady from Washington State, her name is Tracy. She was a huge Carpenters fan. And this happened in the early 80s, shortly after Karen Carpenter's death, I believe, in 1982. And her some friends were listening to some Carpenters music. And they thought, wouldn't it be a good idea to have a seance and try to call up her spirit? So that's where we get to the kind of corollary to the Ouija board that you were talking about. So without kind of knowing what they were doing, they all gathered together in a room. It was her, a friend of hers, her friend's sister, and Tracy's brother. So there were 4 kids. And they said they didn't know what they were doing. And I think that's where the danger is when you don't know what you're doing. Just what they'd seen on movies and TV. So they went upstairs to this friend's bedroom, sat on a mattress in a circle, and held hands. And out loud, they said that they wanted to speak with Karen Carpenter. And they asked the universe to use their energy and allow her to come through us. And they even had an album playing of the Carpenters and some candles lit. On the door that was closed into this room, there was a hook where a hanger was. And there were no clothes on the hanger. So they proceeded with the seance while holding hands. They said, come through us, do something, make something in the room move. They were all looking around the room. Tracy looked up at the hanger and saw the hanger moving slightly back and forth. And that's a little disconcerting. She said, you guys, look at the hanger, look at the hanger. The other three all looked at the same time. Her friend, the one whose room they were in, was the same age. And she saw the hanger moving and was a little startled. The two younger kids, though, instantly flipped out. Both of them jumped off the bed. Tracy's friend's little sister fainted right on the spot. And Tracy's brother started to run to jump out of the window.
Oh, wow.
He was going to jump out of the window because that was the only way out of the room, and he wasn't going to go through that door where the hangar was.
Well, he meant business.
Yeah, he meant business, so who knows what he saw. I guess we're going to find out in a minute. So Tracy stopped her brother. He had actually opened the glass. He was in absolute panic, an absolute panic. So she got everybody calmed down. They literally dragged the one girl down the stairs. She was still out cold, and she revived when they got to the living room downstairs. Now, the friend's mother was not at home at that time. She was coming back in about 10 or 15 minutes, so they wanted to figure out what was going on. They felt guilty that they were doing something they probably shouldn't have been. So anyway, they asked the kids, what did you see to faint and want to run out of a window? And the girl said, while she was crying and hyperventilating, I saw a hand on the hanger. And then the next thing I knew, I was lying on the floor. So she saw not just the hanger moving, but a hand. And then the brother was asked, what did he see? And he said, I saw Karen Carpenter dancing. He said, quote, Karen was holding the hanger with one hand and she was dancing. And that's what was making the hanger sway. He said she was wearing a gauzy type flowing dress. And he said that she took her right leg and started to lift it up, but it kept going straight up at an irregular angle, like a contortionist, like legs aren't supposed to go beyond her shoulder. He said that's when he was going to jump through the window, even if he had to do it without opening the glass. He was planning on getting out of that place, even if he had to go two stories down. Now, thank goodness he didn't. He could have literally killed himself. Terrible situation. So Tracy and her friend, they realize they have to get upstairs because there's candles burning and a record player playing. So they go upstairs, and Tracy says it's one of the scariest moments of her life because there was the song, There's a Kind of Hush. If you remember the There's a Kind of Hush, that one.
Uh-huh.
Well, anyway, they walked in the room and they heard this. There's a kind of hush. Tsh. There's a kind of hush. Tsh. There's a kind of hush. And it kept repeating. Tracy said she was standing there and she had chills all over her body. They took the needle off the record, blew out the candles. It got out of there. So the mom comes home. And the mom says, oh, you kids have been so good, not knowing about the seance, that we are going to take you out for ice cream. So they all go out for ice cream and they turn on the radio.
Oh, God.
Now, yeah, you see it coming. So anyway, no cassettes at that time. I mean, there were cassettes, but they weren't playing a cassette. They weren't playing an 8-track, and CDs really weren't popular yet. I think they'd just literally been introduced in the market right around that time. So you, not something you'd have in your car. And guess what song came on?
I don't want to.
There's a kind of hush. Yes. And then the kid said, could you please turn that off? And they went and had their ice cream. But Tracy says that is an experience she'll never forget. And with apologies to the Karen Carpenter family, I don't think that Karen Carpenter came back and haunted a lot of children. But I do think that the possibility there was an imposter spirit who said, let's give the kids what they want. Let's show them Karen.
Mm. Well, needless to say, Tracy and the gang that night didn't require ice cream to get a chill, if you know what I mean.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. I mean, it's just, it's kind of freaky. And I mean, Karen Carpenter had a very unique voice, and it was very in maybe not the way that you usually think of it, but it was a very soulful voice, a very soul touching voice. So you layer that on top of it, and it really does kind of have an eerie feel to it.
I could see that, especially given the circumstances. But that story about that part of the story about the contortionist element.
Can you imagine? I imagine it in my mind's eye, and you kind of see her leg go up at like this unnatural angle, and that's just frightening.
Reminds me of a couple of things. The Evil Dead, of course, which is more humorous than scary, but nonetheless, I mean, you know, if you're alone in a cabin at night out in the woods watching it, yeah, you could get a little creeped out. Also reminds me a little of the that famous story of the Bell Witch. You remember that one, Jim?
Yeah. You know? Absolutely. And we've had people on about the Bell Witch before. And the thing is that I never discount these stories because I think that truth is a lot stranger than fiction. And I believe that, again, I think it's risky to call specific things up because it's kind of like, you're dialing random telephone numbers and you don't know who you're going to reach on the other end. And I think there's something to that. I think these spirits sense, maybe not so nice spirits, maybe more malevolent spirits, sense the seeking and they take the opportunity. And one of my callers, and he was just a caller who was telling a story, but he had done some study on the Ouija board and he compared, and this wasn't a Ouija board story, but I think it's the very similar. The Ouija board, he compared it to dressing up in your Sunday finest and your best jewelry and going to the worst part of town at 3 o'clock in the morning and walking down the street. It's like you're kind of, I hate to say it, you're kind of asking for it, so to speak.
Yeah, I could see that. Boy, I tell you, speaking of seeing things, I also wanted to let you know, I love the cover of this edition of the book. For those just tuning in, of course, True Ghost Stories, Jim Harold's Campfire, Volume 4. We're up to 4 of these now. This cover features what reminds me a bit of like Ghost Rider, you know, this flaming spirit on a motorcycle. that's an all-time, just archetypal ghost image. But, you know, I also want to point out for people, if you're thinking about whether you want this book or not, in the Religion and Spirituality /Occult/Unexplained Mysteries section in the Kindle store, this is already the number one seller. Did you know that, Jim?
I knew it was doing well. I know it has done each one of the books at one time or another have been number one in the supernatural category. And the thing that I love, and I tell people, you know, you can get it as a paperback, which is a traditional paperback price, what you would pay for it. And you can do that by going to Amazon or jimheroldbooks.com, which essentially will give you the links to all the books at the Amazon store. So you can get it as a paperback if you're a fan. But what I say is that, you know what, why not save a few bucks? You can get any one of these books for $2.99 on the Kindle store. And we're talking about a 260-page book with 70 stories. I think that's one of the best deals out there. And what I like to hear is this idea that people take these, and these books in some ways are a fire starter. Not that people are ripping out the pages using them for kindling. Hopefully not. But you take one of these books, whether it's the paperback or you take the Kindle version, and you go to a party or a campfire or a family gathering, particularly around this time of the year, and you tell one story or two stories from the book. And then somebody says, hey, that's nothing. Wait till you hear what happened to me. So I look at the books as not only being something to read for enjoyment and entertainment and maybe to learn a little bit about different people's experiences, but also to kind of facilitate the telling of stories at various functions this time of year. I think that's a fun part of it. And I've got to say, as kind of disgusting as it is, it's a great bathroom reader too, because, you're looking at 2 or 3 pages max per story. So you got a lot packed in here. So if you have just a few minutes in that situation, or maybe you're waiting on a bus, public transportation, wherever it might be, and you need something that you can read quickly and digestibly, this is certainly something you do it. And you can also read it before you go to bed at night, but I can't guarantee that you'll be able to sleep.
Yeah, that's not exactly recommended reading for right when you're going to bed, especially a couple of these stories. Maybe not all of them are quite as disconcerting, but I know that one that really caught my attention, when we come back from this break, I want to talk about, because it reminds me a little of something that was related to me about a real Appalachian mystery, one that I'm intimately involved with, as listeners of this program will know. I'm Micah Hanks. My guest is Jim Harold. We're talking about his latest book, True Ghost Stories, Jim Harold's Campfire, Volume 4. We'll be back right after this with more True Ghost Stories from our guest here on the Grayling Report.
You're listening to the KGRA Digital Broadcasting Station, Van Buren, Arkansas, Sarasota, Florida.
One of those ghost stories, one of those legends that I grew up on here in Western North Carolina involves the famous Brown Mountain Light. Now, I prefer the plural because I know for a fact, kind of like the legends about Bigfoot, there is more than one. But for a long time, it was referred to as the Brown Mountain Light. It was a ghost light that people throughout the Linville Gorge, and specifically around Brown Mountain, North Carolina, people said that they would see. And years ago, I began to hang around the Linville Gorge a lot in the summer, getting to know the locals, heading up to Wiseman's View. I've never been fortunate enough to really have a full-on observation, but I've seen a lot of photographs that people have taken of these weird earth lights. But there was a conversation, or two actually, that have happened over the years that I've had with firefighters. Firefighters in the region are very interesting because the firefighters are the ones that tend to go out. They're called late at night when people see strange illuminations on the side of the mountain because people are afraid there's a bonfire maybe that's gotten out of hand or a range fire that's breaking out. And so these firefighters will go out. And one gentleman told the strangest story one night as he was walking through a part of the Linville Gorge. He said that there was this area of the ground that just seemed to glow, almost like St. Elmo's fire, but he said it was very different. It was like this light was literally coming up out of the leaves off the forest floor and just coming up into the air. It wasn't fire. It was just this almost ghostly illumination. And he said, I'd always wondered if maybe this was one of the manifestations of the Brown Mountain lights that people talk about seeing. Welcome back, by the way. It is the Graylian Report. We're talking with Jim Harold. And as we lead into this section of the program, I bring it in with this story because there was a story, Jim, in your new book, True Ghost Stories, Jim Harold's Campfire 4. The story is called Fairy Fire, and this sounded so similar to this tale that I was told once, although maybe a little different and certainly a little more ethereal. You want to share that story with us?
Yeah, this is one, you know, one thing I like about the books. There are certainly the really scary ones, like the demon one that I shared at the beginning, and to some extent the Karen Carpenter story. But they're what I call head scratchers, like kind of hinting that the universe is not quite as easily put into a box as sometimes we want to do it. And I think this story is one of those. Evelyn from Arizona tells a story where her and her husband went out with their next door neighbor for dinner. And she was very insistent that I know that there was no alcohol involved. So they had a lovely dinner and they returned home and the neighbors invited them both over for coffee and dessert. And again, no alcohol or substances of any type were involved. So it was a hot day in June and they ended up instead of having coffee, they had cake and ice water and great conversation. Now, they left a little early, 8:45, because the husband had to be up the next morning very, very early for work. And they decided to take their leave. They lived literally within walking distance, about 200 feet away. So they began their long, quote, trek back home. Now, Evelyn said it was a pitch moonless night. And they live in a kind of rural slash suburban area. They couldn't see much. But she had a little keychain that had a flashlight on. So they used that to illuminate it. So they were walking along their friend's asphalt driveway, which is lit with solar light, so they could find their way. Then they got to the dirt road, which leads to their house. And as soon as they got on the dirt road, she heard a rustling sound beside her on her right. Now, on her left side, there's a huge ranch with a cow pasture, but the cows weren't around that week, so she said she didn't think it was a cow walking alongside them. And it actually startled her quite a bit. She said she was actually terrified because she noticed when they would stop, the rustling would stop. So she felt like there was something almost stalking them. And she used her little keychain. And she didn't see anything. She kind of looked for something and didn't see anything there. And she mentioned to her husband that she was very scared and she was actually physically clinging to him. She had been quite a bit frightened. And he said, well, you think that's scary. Why don't you look at the ground? So she did. Now, what she saw was not the dirt road, but she saw that the ground was fluorescent green. She says green like a neon sign green. She said they were beside themselves as they'd never seen anything like it. They had no idea what it was. Now, both of them were extremely focused on walking straight and getting home. They weren't tempted to look down too much or pick anything up. She said the green fluorescent rocks on the road continued to be green until they reached their house. The whole road, in fact, was green. She said it was like we were following a fluorescent green road like the yellow brick road in The Wizard of Oz. Again, she said, no drink, no alcohol. None of us were drugged, nothing like that. All they had to drink at dinner was a fruit iced tea, and that was it. Pomegranate iced tea, non-alcoholic, plus some water. That was it. They weren't on any type of medications that would have altered their mind in any way. So when they approached their house, they had a motion-detecting light that was always on very dimly, and as something approaches, it would get brighter. Well, for some reason, that night, the light didn't work. It was totally off. And again, it never worked again after that night. She said she was glad to reach her house with no incident. She had no explanation to what was rustling and stalking them and what caused this strange fluorescent green on the road. She said she had some friends who own a metaphysical shop in Bisbee, Arizona, and she happened to tell them what happened to them. And they smiled and they said, you encountered fairy fire. And they looked at each other, her husband and her, Evelyn, and asked, what is fairy fire? And they said that it's an old Scottish folklore that fairies were some sort of beings and that they try to lure weary travelers by using this fairy fire. They were trying to lure them into their dimension and their world by the sound of the rustling and by the fluorescent green rocks in the road. Evelyn says she was told by her friends if she would have stopped to pick up a rock or had gone ahead to investigate what the rustling was, that they would have fallen into their dimension. She said, luckily for them, they were so focused on getting home that their energy overpowered that of the fairies. That was supposedly the explanation. So, I mean, this is one of those stories, Micah, where I don't really know how to categorize it. I don't know what it is. I don't know what it could be. It's best categorized as just something really weird, one of these head scratchers that, again, hints that the whole nature, if you take Evelyn at her word, and I do, she was very sincere in what she said. I think this happened. What in the world could it be? I don't know.
It would be interesting to see if a more skeptical take on this story discounted her testimony, because I hear stories like this all the time. And although I try not to put my rational scientific hat on when we're telling ghost stories, I just have to add, because of the prevalence of stories pertaining to the so-called Brown Mountain Lights that I mentioned in the lead-in before your story here, in this region where I live, I noticed that there's a skeptical attitude, and I've been very skeptical of a lot of interpretations and a lot of reports of these lights, but in the broader sense of studying what scientists occasionally call nocturnal illuminations of various origin, there are a number of different things that sound similar to what she describes, everything from bioluminescent life forms or fungi and things along those lines to something akin to St. Elmo's fire. There may be a variety mm-hmm. of different circumstances that would be conducive to an illumination the likes of which she describes. And so, again, I'm wary of trying to say that people imagine things or that they simply make things up, because how often have people been accused of being liars or attempting to hoax or pull the wool over someone's eyes? And it turns out that, in fact, maybe they weren't lying, and in fact, they may have been witnessing some rare natural phenomena.
Yeah, I buy into that possibility. And I'm not saying that is the case, right, but I think that is a possibility. And I will say this, when I select these stories, people say, well, you know, you've had hundreds of stories, if not well over 1,000 stories on your podcast over the last 6 years. So how do you pick them? And one of the criteria is if I think the person is credible in the sense that they are very sincere in what they are telling. I believe fully that Evelyn, and with our prior stories today, that people are telling me the straight scoop and what the way they interpreted it and what they said happened to them. Now, could there be natural explanations for some of these stories? Absolutely, I think there could be. There's one in the book which is more in the UFO realm about a young man who saw literally a cloud in the shape of an eagle dancer, a Native American figure. And I often wonder with things like that, a Project Bluebeam and different things that the military is involved in. And I've heard multiple cases in the American Southwest like this. And that makes me wonder, is somebody up to projecting something into the sky. So sometimes I think there are logical explanations, but that doesn't mean the person's lying. They're just saying, this happened to me. What it is, I don't necessarily know. Here are some possibilities. So to me, I base veracity on the sense, is the person truly communicating something in the way it happened to them and the way they believe it happened to them? And in these cases that I include here, the answer is yes. Now, whether they're rational explanations, that's always possible.
Yeah, I guess you and I wouldn't qualify for being proper skeptics in the modern sense of the use of that term. But again, I don't think that it's warranted and necessarily fair or even wise to always assume that someone who has an incredible story is just lying or grossly mistaken. Sometimes if we were to take these stories for what they appear to be, we might learn something. Just as an example, in fact, there was a study that I believe appeared in the journal The Lancet recently. But this story was carried in the Daily Mail talking about how apparently, according to what is being described by some as the most extensive scientific investigation into the phenomenon known as near-death experiences, almost 1 in 5 heart attack patients who were brought back to life had claimed to have had one of these NDEs. It says that 62 patients reported an NDE, of whom 41, and this is of a total of 344 heart patients who had been resuscitated after cardiac arrest, 41 of whom described a deep experience during a special state of consciousness, as they put it. These included out-of-body experiences. Some just had more generally pleasant feelings. Some claimed that they'd seen a tunnel or a light in the distance. Some claimed that they had encountered deceased relatives. And others had had that classic scenario of their entire life being shown to them during this experience. Now, again, as science seeks to understand the commonality between these experiences, those kind of cases, especially those that occur in a medical environment, are very interesting to me. I've had friends, in fact, who have described hovering above their body during open heart surgery and being able to look down and see themselves seeing the doctors working. Mm-hmm. You know, I've had friends tell me this story, not just something I read on a website or that I see on a television show. I'm fascinated by those stories. I know in your book, you had one such story about a physician who met what he claimed was the supernatural.
Yeah. And I mean, I want to be clear. I that was my title. I said he met the supernatural. He was a little more unclear on what it was, but it was. And he certainly, I think this opened his mind and has given him an open mind.
And let me just say, Jim,
supernatural.
You mentioned too that, of course, with this, and I want people to remember this as they're hearing these stories, you collect these stories from your listeners and people who submit these stories to you, right?
Exactly. We have the Campfire Podcast, Jim Harold's Campfire, and you can get that, you know, you guys are obviously savvy. You're listening to this podcast. You can get wherever fine podcasts are heard, whether it's my site, jimharold.com, iTunes, wherever. And it's grown quite a bit in popularity, just was recently featured in a big way on iTunes. Very appreciative of that. So what I do is I go through the shows. Each show will have 5, 6 caller stories. People call actually from all around the world, which this story that we're going to talk about is from the United Kingdom. And when it comes time to do a book every year, I go through and I say, okay, here are 50 or so, 60 shows. Let's pick best, most interesting, most sincere, the stories that resonate that I feel will resonate with the audience the most. And so this is kind of the cream of the crop in my view.
Now, I want to also point out about the story we're about to cover, which will be the last one we have time for today. But this being a physician, however he classified this, he certainly, as a listener, felt that this story met that criteria when he sent it to you.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. And the thing is that this is Farbod from the United Kingdom. And I love talking to people like this because not that there's, you know, some of us are really into this stuff and we watch all the shows and we read the books and so forth, and we're really into it. And then you have people who are maybe a little even more believing than I am, who believe pretty much everything. But then you've got people that come, you know, who have a science background and very kind of just the facts background. I love talking to those kind of people because it's interesting to see them open up their mind to the possibility of something greater, I guess you would say. Mm-hmm. And this one happened to Dr. Farbod. He was, I guess they call it qualifying over there to become a physician. And he was, I guess you would equate it, I believe, to an internship here. And he was working in the emergency room, kind of doing the grunt work, you know, putting splints on fingers, doing the kind of thing that, you know, emergency room doctors do, particularly when they're just starting out. You know, the kid comes in with a runny nose and he attends to it. And his bleeper, I guess they call it a bleeper over there, went off. And it turned out that he was called up to the fourth floor because there was a patient in cardiac arrest and they needed help. They needed more people. Obviously, this guy was in a very bad way. So they call him up and he's walking up the steps and there's four flights and he gets up to the third flight and he sees an elderly man come out of one of the wards, the doors. And the thing that was notable about that was the man was wearing a mint green T-shirt, nothing else. So he was nude from the waist down, which Farbod says, you know, this happens. You have elderly patients, maybe with dementia, those kind of things. So he distinctly recalls opening up the door of the ward, calling into the nurses, said, nurses, can you please come out and assist this man? He's obviously in distress. Well, distress in a sense, he was half naked. So he thinks no more of it. He goes, he doesn't wait for the nurses. He goes about his way to help this man. And he gets to the room and he gets the surprise of his life because who is lying in the bed? The same man he just saw moments ago. And obviously this guy hasn't gone anywhere. He's in full cardiac arrest and there's a team of people trying to save his life.
Huh.
And Dr. Farbod, as they say in Britain, was kind of gobsmacked.
To say the least.
And he kind of, you know, was stopped in his tracks and somebody says, Farbod, what's wrong? And he's like, oh, nothing. And he gets his senses about him and goes about his work. Long story short, the man dies. There's not much he can do for him. He's too far gone. And obviously this has been going on for some time. So Farbod thinks about it and he said, well, I was going up the steps quickly. Maybe I was lack of oxygen or something. He said, I'll go to the nurse's station on the third floor and see if they found this man. Maybe I was mistaken. And they were a little taken aback and said, well, the only thing that we were distressed about was the fact that there was no one there. There was no man there. The man you described did not exist. And Farbod goes on to say, you know, it seems like this may have impacted his whole view of medicine because he's gone on to practice. And he says, sometimes, you know, it's hard to reconcile something like this, but he considers medicine more of an art than a science. The science of it, he says, is based on a lot of stats and being able to interpret risks, understanding various aspects of the very hard science of medicine, which would be chemical, physiology, anatomy, and things like that. He said, yeah, one thing that he has never discounted when treating people in his practice over the years is the consciousness aspect of medicine. How important it is to cater to people's psychological needs and their spiritual needs, whether you personally, as a physician, believe it or not. He says, it has great power over the well-being of people. You always have to respect it, whether you agree with it or not. He says, he's had moments in his career where someone's spiritual beliefs or their actual faith in the art or science of medicine itself has made the medicine work in a way that probably wouldn't be explicable in a statistical or physiological format. But it does work. He says, everyone knows about the placebo effect, and that makes people feel better.
Mm-hmm.
So he says he can't discount the power of human consciousness, whether it is an externalized force or not. He says he's not sure. He says, I've seen things like I've explained to you, which makes me think that perhaps there is something beyond the biomechanical workings of the human body. And I love that when you've got a man of science, obviously with his head screwed on straight, but with the wisdom and the willingness to say, hey, maybe there's something here beyond just the materialistic and something I don't understand. I mean, to me, that's someone to be admired.
That is, yeah, and truly a strange story. So if this, for lack of a better term, Jim, I mean, this apparition that he observed was indeed representative of the man who had gone into cardiac arrest, I mean, right down to being the man missing his trousers, I mean, there are so many questions that come to mind, which is, it's very similar to one that is often asked about ghosts in general. If a ghostly presence is some apparitional form that lingers beyond a person's bodily death, why then do ghosts appear wearing clothing? Does this indicate that the ghost is actually, rather than just an apparitional presence based on the bodily energy, you know, that persists somehow beyond the physical, Does it indicate that the ghost is more a sort of a projection, a psychological, yes. You know,
it's so funny you ask that, because literally last night I did a webinar with Lloyd Auerbach for my Plus Club. You've done them before and did a fine job, I must say.
Thank you.
And he literally brought up that very point about ghosts wear clothing.
What's an important point?
Yeah.
You know?
It is. But the thing is that you have to wonder. I mean, the natural question to me is, was that man's soul literally departing off the scene? I mean, I guess you would call it logical question. I mean, what would be the, unless it was some type of precognition by the physician that he was, that's the other possibility, which I just literally thought of. I've never thought of that before. Was that him seeing the patient before he actually literally saw him? I don't know, but and that's the reason, that is the last story in the book. And I always like to leave the readers with something to think about, a head scratcher, something to maybe lead to deeper questions. And that's why I decided to end the book with that particular story.
Boy, that one certainly does it. I mean, again, is it a premonitory function on behalf of the doctor himself, or is this some, again, literal? Again, I almost can't say apparition, because it seems almost more like a projection of the dying man's consciousness.
Right.
But it's certainly not unfamiliar to those who take seriously the possible existence of ghosts, which, again, makes me ask this, Jim, as we are kind of winding things down here. What is a ghost? How do we really define a ghost? Look, you've done 4 books and innumerable interviews on podcasts, collecting people's stories, interviewing experts. You know, you must have gleaned your own opinion, if nothing else, about what you think a ghost actually is. Does a ghost in your mind conform to the mythical presence of a spirit that lingers after bodily death, or do you view ghosts as being maybe something more, or perhaps several different manifestations of all these things? I mean, what is a ghost to you?
Well, first of all, I don't know, because I always say I'm not a expert. I just ask the questions. But I mean, obviously, you can't do this for 10 years and not come up with some pet theories.
Sure.
I do think there's something to the idea of residual haunting or the stone tape theory that has always appealed to me. It just makes sense. In fact, in the webinar with Lloyd, he recalled a case where he had done an investigation. I believe it was for the old Sightings television program. And people reported seeing a murder reoccur in this one particular house. But the interesting thing was, the killer wasn't dead. He was in prison.
Oh.
But the idea of this almost stone tape kind of residual haunting, so I think there's something to that. I would not discount the idea of there being something to, in some cases, the dead trying to contact us in some way. So I think those are two. And then sometimes I do think that it can be imagination. I think we can project these things and see them. So I hate to say it, but it's almost like a ABC, answer A, answer B, answer C, or all of the above. I kind of lean towards all of the above.
Well, yeah. I mean, again, there are a lot of questions. The only thing I'll say is this. Until we start seeing, and some claim maybe that we have, but until we start hearing reports of ghosts from the future, or what we can at least assume to be just that, then to me, it seems that the idea of something from the past projected onto the present, i.e. in the form of a ghostly manifestation, seems to meet certain criteria in terms of the thermodynamic arrow of time, which physicists describe. And thereby, it seems that perhaps ghosts, interestingly, conform to certain thermodynamic laws of the universe. And that, to me, perhaps is a clue. But again, it's just that. I don't think any complete picture has emerged. But through the study of these kinds of stories, you know, and credible testimony from certain individuals, it's interesting. It sheds perhaps some light, and maybe we'll continue to over the years. But if nothing else, we can certainly, especially around Halloween, enjoy these stories. We always enjoy, of course, Jim Harold, having you here on this program. And I want to thank you again for coming on as a guest here on the Graylian Report. Tell folks one more time where they can find your book and whatever else you've got going on just as well.
Well, you can check out everything I do over at jimharold.com. That's JimHarold.com. You can find the books on Amazon, wherever country you might be in. They should be in all the international stores. If you want a one handy dandy link to all the books, jimharoldbooks.com is great. Of course, you can listen to the podcasts on iTunes and all the other apps and places where you hear podcasts. And the way my podcasts work is you can get the last 90 days, the most recent shows, for absolutely free. And if you find yourself to be a super fan and you really enjoy the content, I have a ton more in my Plus Club, but I always direct people to the free stuff. And actually, my free newsletter. And if you sign up this month, I know Mike and I are both big fans of In Search Of. This October, I'm drawing one name from the continental United States from that email list, and we'll be sending out one 21-disc DVD set of In Search Of, and that's absolutely free. That's my email list over at jimherold.com. And sign up for that. That will keep you up to date with everything I do, plus sending out news stories every week. And maybe you'll be the lucky winner of that In Search Of set, which is my all-time favorite paranormal television show.
It really can't be beat. Jim Herold, ladies and gentlemen, once again, visit jimherold.com. You can actually find articles of mine there as part of the ongoing Paranormal Brain Trust series. So, yeah, and of course, all the aforementioned fine content. Jim, once again, thanks for joining us.
Thank you, Mike. It's always a pleasure, and thank you for allowing me to do this.
And of course, for all of you at home, we certainly hope that you enjoyed it as much as Jim and I have enjoyed being here with you and sharing these stories here as we're leading up to Halloween. Hey, keep in mind, here in the coming weeks, just in time for Halloween, we'll also be doing a special seasonal edition of the Paranormal Report that Jim and I do together. Be sure and keep your eyes peeled for that in the days to come. And that will be the final word this week on the Grailian Report on behalf of all of us here in the bunker. Caleb Hanks, Jeremy London, Chris Hayes, Matthew Oakley, John Anderson, Dick Oakley, Tyler Pittman, Rayson Robin Hobbs, and yours truly, Micah Hanks. We bid you adieu, my friends. In the spirit of the season, as always, stay strange out there. We'll talk to you again soon.
Listening to the Grailian Report with Micah Hanks. Any rebroadcast or duplication of this program or program content without express written permission is strictly prohibited. The Grailian Report, in direct cooperation with the internet website, GrailianReport.com.